obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Dwayne for inviting me out to be at the meeting, the Night Owl meeting, the old tweakers meeting, I guess. I'm glad to be here. It's been a good evening. So I'm glad to get out of my room, really, because I ran out of snacks. So I want to thank the committee for the little gift basket and my lovely wife, Rosie, for making the trip down. There you are. With us tonight, and it's always good to be with her. Tony talked from Bakersfield and did a great job, and the last time I was in Bakersfield was about 5 or 6 years ago. I talked at their conference out there, and we were at the Marriott, and we shared the hotel with 2,000 Jehovah's Witnesses. That ain't that bad. But around 2 o'clock, I had a desire to grab my big book and go door to door and ask them, just, you know, Bill and Bob love you, you know, just to, not that I don't like to get even, but, you know, just. But it's good to be here, and it's always safer once you're in the room, you know. I got a busy head. I got a head that just loves to chat, and no matter how tired I am, my head just loves to chat. Could be physically beat, like we were last night. Boy, around 2:30, that old head just, hey, I know you're in there. Let's chat. Come on, let's talk about when you were a baby and bring you right up to date, for God's sakes, you know. And the frustrating part about that is we just did it the night before, you know, and. It's never anything good, you know. Just constantly reminding me what a loser I am, you know. And my sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for close to 30 years and not amount to a damn thing. So, you know, I don't know where you think you're going if you're new, but the highest I've ever gotten here is sober, basic human being, active member of my own home group. And my home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower, California. And that's where I found my God, was in my home group. I didn't come here with nothing, you know. And I came here with just a little bit of hope that this guy that I called my sponsor, that maybe I'm betting my life that he's right, you know. And by golly, he was, you know. And I never want to forget what it's like to be new in Alcoholics Anonymous and how important it is to shake those hands of the folks that you don't know here. It's easy for me to go to that home group and get around guys that I sponsor and get glued to that wall, you know, and don't get peeled off only if there's a fire, you know. And I got to remember, man, that, you know, there's new guys that have never been to that meeting before. And what was that like when somebody came up to you, you know, and shook your hand and stuff like that? You know, and so that keeps me in good stead, you know. I've got good folks. I was just a loser in high school. And, you know, when you're a loser in high school, people are always bringing people to your side to compare you to, you know. And why don't you try to be like Bobby, you know. And I remember being a freshman in high school and got drunk, and me and my dad are in the principal's office, you know, and my dad sees this picture of the star quarterback on the wall, you know, and he says, you know, why don't you try to be like Coy, jackass, you know, and I look at the guy, and I said, all right, I'll give it a shot, you know, and next year I got arrested for being drunk on campus and loaded on barbiturates, and I stole the janitor's cart, and I drove it through the library doors, you know, and had to get that book back, right, you know. And so me and my dad and my probation officer are in the principal's office, you know, and the principal says, hey, look at it. Why don't you try to be like Coy, you know. And I said, all right, I'll give it a shot. My junior year, I'm in the over there, and my sister starts dating some guy, and she brings it home, and it's old number 7 right there in my living room, you know. And my mom comes running over in her muumuu, why don't you try to be like Coy, for God's sake, you know. My senior year, I'm in the Torrance jail getting ready to do 90 days, and the Daily Breeze newspaper comes sliding under there, and it says that old Coy made all pro CIF, you know, and I go, my God, I'd like to be like Coy. He's moving right along. And lo and behold, in old AA town, I'm about 5 years sober, and I'm in downtown Los Angeles, and I'm in my plumbing truck, you know, and I got my cardboard rolled up because things are going good in my life, you know. And it's vogue that on every street corner in Los Angeles, there's always a guy selling peanuts or oranges, or he has this sign that says, I'll work for food, like you don't, you know, and maybe you don't, I don't know, you know. And I look like a guy that needs help. People are always giving me pamphlets telling me that Jesus and Jehovah and all these guys are coming to town and I need to talk to them, you know. And I'm sitting there in my van, and this guy with this sign locks eyes with me. And I go, oh, man, I got $2 and he ain't getting it, you know. And he comes over, sticks his head in that window and goes, Larry, Larry Thomas. And I go, Coy, it's old number 7, man. And I go, my God, what happened, you know? The guy had it made, and then it dawned on me that if there was any justice in AA, that maybe my sponsor could maybe write this guy a letter saying, why can't you be like Larry, you know? But people have always looked like they've had it made, you know? Everybody's always looked like to me like they're just clicking right along. And I've always had this anchor on my foot and just weird stamped on my forehead, never able to integrate with people and always watching folks, you know, get along well. And I just, you know, I just struggled all the time, just struggled for small talk and, you know, always felt, you know, out of the picture, you know. Like I said, I had great parents, born in Detroit and brought to California when I was about 3 or 4 years old, and my mom had me in a little foster home over there in Gardena, and my mom's a great lady. My mom's a little Scandinavian lady, and my mom loved diet pills. She was always eating that speed and running around the house and making afghans, you know, and everything in the house had fresh afghans, you know, everywhere, you know. The chairs had afghans, couches had afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodle heads, you know, and if there was any animals, they had a fresh vest on, you know, and the house was small, and you can hear her in that little room just going to town, you know, and just a busy lady, and no matter what time you got up, she was up doing crap, you know, and a lot of stuff, you know, cleaning with your toothbrush, and just, you know, sorting out nuts and bolts in the garage at midnight, you know, and raking the neighbor's yard around 5 o'clock in the morning, you know. Just a busy lady, and her favorite hobby, and she had a ton of them, but her favorite one was to eat that speed and make these big jigsaw puzzles, these 30 million piece jigsaw puzzles, right, of the Mojave Desert, you know, and she would be excited about that. It's going to be a beige night tonight, honey, you know, and she'd get all excited and run down to Save-On's and get her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because she saved the coupons on the back of them to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in. And she'd take her puzzle and run back home and put her one and only muumuu on she had for 40 years, you know, and start eating this speed and making this puzzle. And if she got a puzzle piece that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers. She'd snip that son of a bitch down, you know, wedge it right in there. And, you know, I just love being around my mom. To this day, I like being around my mom. I just loved being around my mom. But lo and behold, when I was to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and would be going through this process and be taking a fourth and a fifth step with the sponsor, a fact-finding process it talks about. A fact-finding process. And all over these meetings we hear, the truth will set you free. And I never knew what the truth was. What the heck do you mean, the truth? And it took me years in Alcoholics Anonymous to discover that the truth is what's in that book for us to do. The truth you find in that book as a result of these steps, that's the truth that'll set you free. What you find in there. And what I found in there was a man selfish and self-centered and just consumed himself. Started at a young age. Started with that little lady that I love so much, my mom. And what I would do with a lady that would, like my mom, who would give me love and attention and affection, that would follow me into Alcoholics Anonymous to this day still. And that is, to anybody that would give me love and affection and attention, especially her, I would play her like a fiddle. That there would never be a time too inconvenient for me not to put the touch on that little lady. There would never be an age too old for me not to lean on that lady and play on her emotions. Just drove my dad nuts. And what was to happen to me in Alcoholics Anonymous would be something that I didn't know that I would be able to handle sober, was the discovery of how selfish and self-seeking I am. And how I used to play on that. And I never want to forget, and there's some young guys in here, I never want to forget what it's like to be a young man and be put away for a small period of time. No big time convict, just a little goofy punk kid, and be put away for a little time and have to come back home on a Monday, and I don't show up on a Monday. I show up on a Thursday, and I don't show up at home. What I do is I show up at my mom's place of business. See, my mom's working at a dry cleaner's, and she's cleaning folks' houses, and I'm ashamed of her. But I'm not too ashamed to show up on an April morning in a parking lot with the rain hitting me and my drunken mud on, and I'm about from here to that wall. And I'm just standing in this parking lot with that rain hitting me, and the only thought that I have is she better have a buck. And I walk through that rain and go to that lady's place of business, and one more time I startled her with my presence, which would be an ongoing thing in that little gal's life. And without missing a beat, I ask her for some money, and she breaks out that Woolworth wallet of hers, and a picture of me falls out when I'm about 8 years old on a little league team. The only decent picture she'd ever have of me until I meet you guys. And without skipping a beat, she gives me that $2, and I grab that money, and I run off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me, if you're new, take this same man and you bring me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, much like my home group or yours, where every action that I take, my life depends on. And I need to ask you something. How come when my life depends on it, and you were to put the secretary of the meeting that same distance as me and my mom in that parking lot, how come when my life depends on it, I can't walk that distance and ask a man for a job in a meeting that's going to save my life? But I can walk that distance and use my mom and other people like her time and time and time and time again. And I'm here to share with you, if you're new, that it's been my experience, and that's all I got. I don't got a lot of nothing, but I've got some experience here. And with that experience, it's been my experience that if I can find out what is that thing that keeps me from serving you, I will have found a key to life. If I can find out what that thing is that keeps me from serving Alcoholics Anonymous, I will have found the key to life. Because once I began to serve the thing that I wanted so much from, it started bleeding in every area of my life. And if I can walk that distance and ask the man for a job in a meeting that's going to save my life, I will have found the key to life. And the reason that I still have a job in my meetings today isn't so I can run off to Costa Mesa and tell you about it. It's because of close to 30 years, it's been my experience that I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And I always want to remember what it's like and how useful you guys have made me. And that at close to 30 years sober, it's so important for me to still have a job in these meetings because it keeps my ego small enough to become useful to you. And that's what it's all about. If you're new, you are surrounded by people who are successes. And that drove me nuts when I was new. Everybody reeked of being a success. You could just see it with their clothes and their cars, and they just reeked of being a success. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, oh my God, here we go again. Everybody's doing better than me, looking better than me, and here I am one more time with another group of people that I got to fight to fit in. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you are sober one day and you are in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you are a success. But the secret to Alcoholics Anonymous is that it ain't about becoming successful. It's about becoming useful. And I had no idea what you folks had in store for me. That selfishness and that self-centeredness. See, if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will. Make no mistake about that. Which is why it's necessary for me to still do these things, man. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And I never want to forget what it was like to be in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous through old Southern California and look at through these meetings and look at you folks and wonder if I'll ever be in the middle of these meetings. Will I ever have a piece of this thing? Now, my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues and Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk, man. He loved to drink and sneak into his own damn house. It was an amazing thing. Always through my bedroom window, you know. About midnight, he had these big old refinery boots on, you know, and I could feel him sneaking in there because he'd be stepping on me as he's climbing in there. And he stepped on me one night, and I grabbed that boot, and I said, you know, Pop, I said, why don't you, you know, make yourself a key, you know. You know, have Mom make it. My God, she's up anyway, you know. And I can hear the Hoover going now, you know. And I tell you, man, I wanted my dad's approval at such a young age. I was always chasing his approval. But I tell you, I adopted this thing. I don't know where I got it. But at a very young age, I adopted this thing that if there's a frown or some type of discomfort on your face, I got to find out what that is. And I assumed the guilt for that. And my dad was, the only time he was happy is when he was stewed, you know what I mean? And alcohol wasn't a stranger in our house, you know. I mean, my God, you know, these folks, they used it if you were feeling bad, if you couldn't sleep, if you couldn't eat, if, you know, everything. Toothaches, stomach aches, couldn't sleep, they'd cook up that port wine, you know. And, I mean, there was always stuff around the house. And my dad made drinking look good. He made sobriety look a little grim, you know. But he was a happy drunk. And, man, I wanted to be like my dad. And I chased his approval, you know, because I was doing so many disapproving things, you know. But I wanted the old man to like me so much, you know. But at around the age of about 11 years old, you know, I was doing everything that all these other guys were doing, and it seemed like people all around me were grasping and developing lives and able to start moving in the lives, and they had some type of direction where they were going, and I'm not clicking, man. I'm not getting it. And I got this fear going on with me, and, you know, I got this tremendous amount of guilt and shame in that family because I don't trust my mom because she's letting my dad move her around, and I don't like my dad because he's moving my mom around, and I'm assuming the guilt for all that, and I wished I could have been loving him, but I don't trust him, you know. And at about 11 years old, there was four of us in a garage, and we started passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And I tell you, I didn't have to fight to feel good anymore, man. It evened out the playing field, and that's all I wanted, you know. Shut that little head up and just even out the playing field and quieted that little gut, and it just turned Howdy Doody into James Dean in two drinks, man, you know. And I loved it, and I never laughed so hard in my whole life, man. Never threw up so much, you know. And I kissed my first Latin woman that night, and that was a big deal, you know. It was my aunt, but well, what the hell, I put it down as one, you know. That made my old Uncle Jack a little leery when I was around, you know. But, oh yeah, and I knew I stepped into the spot, man. I knew I found something there, because that would be my reference point from that point on. And there would never be anything that I did or felt when I was sober that would match that little window that I would step into when I was drunk. That beautiful window that no matter how many drinks you have, you step into this place where everything's all right. And alcohol would never be a problem to me. Alcohol would always immediately become my answer to no matter what was ailing me. That God-awful thought of what's wrong with you that you always asked yourself, and eventually, you know, everybody else started asking it, you know. And it would just take all that away, man. And every time I drank, and just like some of the folks in here, you know, every time I took a shot of wine or whiskey, I stepped into that beautiful little window. And the trouble with me and the trouble with some folks in this room is that the longer I drank, the smaller that window got. And the smaller that window got. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't stepping into no beautiful little window. But I was marshaled with a dream. I was marshaled with a dream that would haunt me. I was marshaled with a dream that no matter how nasty that last drunk is, I had a dream, and that dream wasn't to be a carpenter or a plumber. That dream would drive me to nuts, and that would be that this time it's going to be different. This time it ain't going to get me. I've got to find a way to keep this in my life if it's the last thing I do. I can't imagine life without it. Everything was predicated on me getting a drink. Everything was predicated on that. And by the time I got in, and I loved cars, I've always loved cars, and by the time I got into high school, I started hanging around these Mexican guys and started dating their sister, and we used to lower our cars down. We used to have these 62 Chevys and just lowered them right down to the ground, you know, and get our hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, you know, and have our white t-shirts and our black khaki pants that came up to here, and drink that wine and drive around and listening to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye, and God, I loved it, man. I was in my little plumbing truck the other day and the Four Tops came on. I just start sinking in my damn truck, man. I had a little Mexican girlfriend named Loopy, and she curled her hair up real big, and her sister would use those soup cans and the noodles were stuck in there, you know, and we'd drive around, drink that Thunderbird wine, wonder what the hell you're looking at, you know. What are you looking at? We'd bounce around with our frowns on because our asses hurt all night, you know. And women were telling me that men who are well endowed had big feet, so I had a pair of 15-inch shoes I was driving around in, man. And had my big hair and my big feet, and I had it made, man. Somebody tripped over my foot tonight, and I felt proud, you know. Let me move that thing, you know. May take a while, you know. I loved it, man, because I wasn't that goofy kid. I wasn't Betty and Bob's boy. I wasn't little Howdy Doody Larry. I hated that name. I never liked that name, Larry. Too many things rhyme with it, you know. Nothing cool, you know. I wanted to be Eric or Mike or something like that, you know. Pooch or somebody, you know. But Larry, you know, I hated that, man, you know. And, man, when I drank, I wasn't Larry, you know. I was Lawrence of Torrance, you know, that's what I was, you know, a little more macho, you know, and I loved it. I ran into a kid like that not too long ago, man, several years ago. I was up there at the Glendale Mall, and this kid comes walking by me, and he's got his mom's earrings on. He's got these big holes in his earlobes, about the size of a, he's drilling out his ears, all right? He's got a ball bearing in his forehead. He's got a ring in his eye. He's got a ball bearing in his nose. He's got a little ring right here chained to his wallet. He walks by me and he goes, "What are you looking at?" I says, "I don't have a damn clue what I'm looking at, you know. I wanted to squirt him with some WD-40 to make sure he keeps moving on, you know." And I started making fun of him. We started talking. And now I sponsor the little guy, you know. He lives down in Chula Vista. His name's Ron, you know, and he used to call me up, "What do you want me to do?" And I says, "Well, Ronnie, why don't you unlock yourself, for God's sakes, you know?" And, "Well, I go to these meetings and I feel so different." "Really?" I said, "Maybe you're the only one wrapped up in a chain link fence, Ronnie. How about that, you know?" And you know, whenever you sponsor somebody, they have your defects of character times 10, right? And one of my, problems is I'm not only an alcoholic, I've got a 5-inch belt of lazy ass that straps around here where I really don't like doing anything, you know? I really don't. It's not that I wake up thinking about my nap is what I do. It takes a long time to me to get into things, you know. After all, we've got tomorrow. Easy does it, you know. And Ron was like that, you know. Ron was like that, and he didn't want to get a job. And one of the things that, you know, if I'm going to sponsor you, you're going to go to work, you know. I mean, and he didn't like that idea, and I understood that. I didn't like it either. I still don't, you know. And I remember him being so excited, you know. He's about 90 days sober, and he calls me up, Sponce. He says, I got a job. And he was just excited. You could just see his little tail wagging, you know. And I said, that's great, kid. That's what I want to hear, man. You took an action. You're going to go out there. Yeah, he says, but it's only part-time. I said, I don't care. You start at part-time, and you just, you know, make the best of it. You know, you show up and you pretend like it's full time, you know. I said, what are you going to be doing? He said, I'm going to be going to a sperm bank 3 times a week. I said, I was hoping for a little bit better than that, you know what I mean? But this guy's excited, and I could just see him, you know, every morning, you know, packing his lunch, you know, wrapping his carrots up and everything, you know, throwing his gloves in the box, you know, and his lunch box, and, you know, grabbing his Hustler magazine and heading off to work, you know, going out to that hands-on job, I guess, you know. But he's doing good now. In fact, he called me up not too long ago. He called me and wrote, let me know that he's back in town. Oh, Ronnie's back, you know, and still sober. But, you know, I was like that, man. I had this monumental ego, you know, and this tremendous amount of laziness about me. And what happens when you, you know, you've got that kind of laziness and that kind of ego is what happened to me is I was the type of guy that grew up doing average things expecting standing ovations. You know what I mean? You go to work and you think the boss is in the office going, Jesus Christ, look at that guy, man. Man, they don't make them like that anymore, you know. And he just does a half-hour lunch. Wow, you know. And, you know, just doing what other folks are doing, but you got to have a parade, right, you know. I love telling this story. My little wife, Rosie, you know, we're both kind of busy in AA, and at night we pass each other in the hallway, you know. And not too long ago, I put a toilet seat on for her, you know, because I don't use it. No, I put a new toilet seat on there, a nice maple toilet seat. And, you know, we'd pass each other in the hallway, and I'd go to the bedroom, and she'd go to the restroom, and she'd come out there, and she wouldn't say a thing. And this drove me nuts for months, man. She'd keep going in there and coming out, not saying anything, and I'm going, my God, how selfish can you be, you know? What are they teaching you at these women's stag meetings, you know? Just use them, you know? Just make them work and use them, you know? And it just drove night after night, week after week, her and her selfish self-centeredness just going in there, brand new piece of wood in there, not one thing said, you know what I mean? And finally, after about 4 months, I had to say something because I ran out of teeth to grind, you know, and she come out of it, and I said, you know, it's a brand new piece of wood you've been sitting on in there, you know, who do you think put that on, God, you know? She says, I know, and it's been loose. You know, and she's just ungrateful that you could get. But anyway, I started hanging around these guys in high school, and we started bouncing around, and my alcoholic life seemed like the normal one. Everything was just, no matter what I was drinking, I was in that spot, you know, and just loving life, man, you know. And the trouble with my life and the trouble with somebody is that the more I drank, the smaller that window got, man. Got into 1969, everybody's going different places, and I thought, well, maybe I'll just go to Detroit and find my roots. And I head out to Detroit, you know, and wound up in Phoenix. Over there, North Central and, you know, Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel. Beautiful place, about 6 floors high. Everybody's got a bathroom, and it's down the hall. Everybody has a TV, it's in the lobby. About $30 a month, and you got a little room and a little window, and you know, and I little Murphy bed, and you look out that window, and you drink, and you dream, and you die. You know, one of these days, it ain't going to be like that. And now I start fantasizing. Now I start seeing these guys drive by me in these work trucks, and their trucks, and they got lunch buckets, and they got dogs. And I'm starting to think, well, you know what? Maybe if I start had some type of normal life like that, maybe my drinking wouldn't be so wild. Maybe I just need to grow up and, you know, God, you know, maybe do like Dad did or something like that. Maybe, you know, that would, because now I'm, you know, I'm starting drinking. I don't know where I'm going to wind up at, you know, and maybe this would just calm me down a little bit, you know. And but the idea of not drinking never enters my mind, right? And so I start on this countless vain attempts to get some type of little job and a little room. And I tell you, you want to give hope to a loser, there is nothing like the hope you get of starting over. And that's one thing that I found in that inventory was my life was a series of fresh starts. I was always starting over because there is nothing more sensational than the feeling of hope that you get when you're starting over. New town, new PO, new motel, you know. Everything's good for 90 days and then it starts getting gray again, you know. And isn't it amazing that you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and to the untrained eye, it looks like that's what happens here. That people come to these meetings, they stop drinking, they get a little car, they get a little job, they get somebody to dance with. And to the untrained eye, it looks like the treatment for alcoholism is normal living. And nothing could be further from the truth. We got folks in this room and many other rooms just like it who've got every material instinct satisfied. But yet they're sitting in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and they're restless and they're irritable and they're discontented. And that's an amazing example for me because the solution to my malady will have nothing to do with the material. You don't need to come to AA to get that. That just takes hard work and good fortune. But the treatment to this malady, this deadly illness that we have, will be and always will be for a guy like me, will be me and you and the perpetuation of that gift. This gift that they're hoping will happen to you as a result of these steps. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's nothing to get here. There's nothing to get in AA. There's plenty to receive, but there's nothing to get here. In fact, the only thing you're going to get is be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life, man. Because this is the longest thing I've ever done against my will. That's, you know. And it seems like folks like me have to do the uncomfortable to get comfortable. That it isn't about convenience. That it's about those little extra efforts. You see, and that's what a home group taught me. A home group taught me that it was more than just sitting down for an hour and a half. That once you start taking part in this thing that you expect so much out of, these childish ideas that I expected from AA when I got here, and this Santa Claus God that I had, and that I had no idea what was in store for me. No idea what was going on here. And I'm sitting in that little room over there in Phoenix, you know, and poking my head out the window, and there's the Wagon Wheel Bar across the street, and it's a beautiful place. It has no windows, just a dirty curtain blowing out there, you know, torn curtain. Go in there and meet a guy named Ernie. Ernie says, I know what we're going to do. Come back here the next morning. He says, I know a guy that'll put you right to work. And I show up the next morning and meet this plumber, and he takes me out to Phoenix, sticks me underneath the house, gives me a transistor radio. I got a pint of PM bourbon. He says, all I want you to do under there is hang copper, kid. That's all I want you to do, and I'll come back in 9 hours and pick you up. And he took off, and I'm underneath this house. And I got this transistor radio. I got a bottle of whiskey. I look underneath the house, and there's a stray cat over there. And I go, my God, I got it made. I got it made under here. I got a transistor. I got a pint. I got a pet, you know. And I like that sneaky thing that nobody knows I'm under there, you know. And all I got to do is bang on that pipe for a little bit and let them know I'm hard at work. And I started drinking that hot bourbon. And 9 hours later, they're dragging me out from underneath that house. And apparently I got drunk and busted up through the floor and robbed a lady of all of her jewelry. And they're pulling me out. This cat comes running out with a bunch of necklaces on, you know. Get fired from that job, you know. Go back to the old Wagon Wheel Bar because that's the answer place. Talk to Ernie. Ernie says, I know what we're going to do. He says, we're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey. And I'm thinking, all right, we're going to start working out, you know. And he had a little bag of speed. And I don't do speed. I've just been drinking wine and doing heroin, minding my own business, you know. I don't want to be an Afghan maker, thank you, you know. And no, we'll just take this stuff and get you down to 95 pounds and we'll go take you to the track and go weigh you in and get our colors and all this. He says, I know it will work. He says, you take this stuff, I'll come back in 2 months and we'll go weigh you in. And he took off. He comes back 2 weeks later. I haven't moved an inch in my little room. I just, I don't want to be a jockey, Ernie. I'm going faster than any goddamn horse I've ever seen in my life, you know. You can put a saddle on me and ride my ass all over Phoenix, you know. And he comes back, he says, you couldn't have possibly taken it. Well, I did, Ernie, I did. I need some more, man. And all I did is just look out my little window. I was looking out my shades every 10 seconds. What's that? What's that? What's that? You know, and chasing a fly around my little room. Anything that's white on the ground, I'm firing it up, you know. It could be a damn toenail. It's going up, you know. Seeing these black and white flashes in the window, and it's the damn sun going up and down, you know. And boy, he come back, I was sucked up to it. You know, just, come on, Ernie, let's get the, you couldn't have possibly taken it. Well, I did, and I need some more, man. Froth was coming out my little mouth. Worst 20 days of my life, man. Went back to the wagon wheel bar, wandered in there, and met another guy, and I started working for this plumber for, I don't know, 2 hours. And I found out that he was younger than me, and I ain't working for a kid, you know. And got my pride, so I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury. You know, went to the county hospital, and they wrote me a prescription for Percodan, and the doctor left me a box of prescription pads that he wanted me to have, and I grabbed that box and just you know, ran down Central, you know, ducked into the old wagon wheel, and Ernie made a call to some guys down in Tucson, and we started writing prescriptions and selling them. Writing prescriptions for Seconal and Tuenol and Nembutal and you name it all. We wrote it all, you know. And damn near took it all, too, you know. And after about 9 months, they caught up with me. And when you're loaded on whiskey and wine and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase like you see. There he goes down the 5. Look at him go. You know, none of that was happening. They got me. I was going 9 miles an hour. The cop didn't even need to be in his car. He was walking alongside the car. Roll down the window, you know. So they stuck me away for no big time convict, 9 months or something. I got out of there, and they gave me a voucher to come back to Los Angeles, and I went to the L.A. County Sheriff's Department over there in downtown City Hall, and they gave me a voucher for a hotel in downtown Torrance, and they put me on Anabuse. And the first time I'd been on Anabuse, first time I'd been sober since I was about 13 or 14 years old. There was nothing in me, and they'd give me this Anabuse, and a little hotel over there in downtown Torrance, the Greyhound Hotel, in 1974. And I don't, you know, I had my license taken away when I was about 13. I wouldn't be able to have that till I, you know, didn't get my license until I was 2 years sober, actually. And so I had to take a bus to this job interview over in El Segundo. I was going to be a janitor at a refinery. And I take this bus ride over to El Segundo, and I'm about 2 hours early. So I start wandering around this little league baseball field and ducked into the dugout there. And got about 2 hours before I go to work, and I, stone cold sober, I went out of my mind. In between hysterical and maniacal, and the paranoia was so bad that my hallucinations stuck, become somewhat catatonic, and somebody called the paramedics and take me to the Harbor General Hospital, and they look at my jacket, and they seem that because of some of the things that have happened to me that maybe I need to go to a state hospital and be observed for about 60 days. And a year later, I came out, totally observed, you know, and nothing in there, you know, and they put me on certain medications that took care of certain things, but I tell you, there's one thing you can't medicate away. This time, it's going to be different. And after two months, I ran out of Thorazine, and they found me over to Overo Street, public drunk, a public nuisance, rolled me up, sent me up the wayside for about 3 months, and brought about 50 of us down to the South Bay Courthouse in Torrance, where I'm going to be sentenced to 2.5 years in the state penitentiary, and we're in a holding tank about this size, and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everybody's gone. All the buses are gone, all the other guys are gone, there's just me and some bologna sandwiches and sitting on a concrete floor with a Vons bag and no hope, wondering what are they going to send me now.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in 1975, a Scottish man with a patch came into a little jail door over there in Torrance, California. And he rolled open that little door and he says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He said, "Come with me, son, you're going to AA." And I thought, AA? Now, those are two initials I've never heard of before. I've heard of OR and PO, but what's AA, you know? Who's this little Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? And is he real, you know? And he certainly was real. He certainly was real. Because looking back well over 30 years, to me, he's what we call a trusted servant. Now, what would make that man a trusted servant for me was this, that he had no business being there. He wasn't on a panel. He wasn't part of H&I. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a probation officer. He was a little refinery worker who got the worst news of his life that day. His wife was dying immediately of a terminal disease. He knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. You see, but somewhere in his home group, somewhere in his book study, somewhere in his 12 and 12 workshop, somewhere in his speaking meeting, that guy was able to sit quietly and grasp and develop a manner of living, which is almost a fallacy today, and grasp a manner of living and live it. And that living is this. Practical experience tells it that nothing will ensure immunity from drinking than intensive work with other alcoholics, that this works when other activities fail. And that thought came across his mind. And he turned his little car around and he headed to the South Bay Courthouse and he talked to Judge Foy and Judge Hollingsworth and they said, "I think we got a guy for you." And that man came down there and took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he put me in the back of his little car, and I'm ready for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch, you know. And he takes me for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that car, he tells me the news. He nailed me. He says, "Larry," he says, "I know you've had a tough life and you feel different. My God, if there's anything that I've ever felt my entire life was different, no matter what group I've ever been around, including AA, It just takes a matter of time when there's something that separates me from you. And that's the biggest problem I have when I'm sober, is that I got to keep from feeling different. Because once I begin to feel different, I begin to make excuses of not to be with you." And he says, "I know you've had a tough life and you feel different." He says, "But Larry," he says, "I'm so glad you're going to meet these people." He says, "I can't wait for you to meet these people in Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "Son, in AA, the more different you feel, the more qualified you are." And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a 15-minute car ride, and he rolled up to this dingy, stinky, smelly, rotten, pukey, filthy Alano club. And I'd never seen that word before in my life, Alano. I mean, what's an Alano? I mean, is that like an elk or a moose or something, you know? Watch for crossing Alanos or something, you know? And he pulled up there, and there's all the Alanos walking around, man, you know. Everybody's got a nickname and a tattoo. He starts introducing me to all these folks, Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Whistling Pete and Dancing, you know, all these other, you know. And I said, "My God, I just left a group of people like this, you know." And little Moose come racing across the, "Hi, honey, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle." I said, "I bet you are." I said, "I'm not it, you know." And some big transvestite comes out of the card room. He starts circling me like a helicopter in Norwalk, you know. And he finally lands. He comes walking up to me in his moo-moo. And he says, "I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting." I said, "I don't think so, big guy, you know. Not till I get a year anyway, you know." And I said, "My God, he's got big feet, you know. And send him to the night owl meeting, you know." And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. And that was the biggest lie that I was telling myself. was that I was coming in and out of AA. I hadn't touched Alcoholics Anonymous. I did something that I'd been doing my entire life, and one more time it came out in my inventory. I sat in a room waiting for people to do something for me. I've been doing that my entire life. From the time I was 13 to the time I was 30, whether it be the state or the county, I've been sitting in rooms waiting for a free check or a block of cheese or a bus pass or something. I've had my hand out my entire life. And wasn't it amazing that what I was waiting to be done to me, God was waiting to do through me? I had no idea that I would be divinely inconvenienced by action here. That what I wanted so much from, I would have to serve. And in and out of these rooms for year after year after year, and the longest I could stay sober was 6 months because I was in heroin. It seemed to take the edge off. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would get me. It was usually this little Montana cowboy, Don. And every time they got me, they were clean and they were sharp like you folks are tonight. And that's why I wear a tie tonight. Not because I think I'm sharp and effective. Because of the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous. Gave me everything that I have in my life today. Everything. And that if I can't show respect for the thing that's saving my life, what kind of member am I? And you folks, you blindsided me. That's one thing my sponsor today has taught me from day one about respect. And he didn't have to point his finger at me. It was caused by little actions. You take care of that coffee pot. If you could show respect for that coffee pot and this meeting that's saving your life, eventually you'll be able to take this out there. You'll be able to show respect to your mother and father, maybe a boss, maybe a daughter. Maybe even the dog won't be afraid of you. Start showing respect instead of demanding it. And that's, I've been demanding it my entire life, and you guys started telling me to having respect for this thing that's saving my life. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me. And May 2nd, 1982, I'm over there at the Don Hotel. I'm going ready to check into the Beacon Light Mission. I will go by a Woolworth window, and there I am. I'm 120 pounds, and I'm yellow. I got everything I got on my back. I look at myself in this Woolworth window, and I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? And I remember I didn't have any dreams. That the only dream I've ever had was killing me. That I had this dream that this time it was going to be different. I had no idea about this malady that I had. I had no idea that I got the type of malady that the memory of my last drunk hasn't sufficient force to keep me sober. And I used to think that because I was down there in that gutter, that certainly that would be enough to, you know, jar my memory whenever. Isn't that amazing? That if you were to take any normal person and have them spend one night with us out there, that son of a gun would swear off forever. That's for damn sure. But not that alky. Not that alky, man. We've got the type of illness that the memory of our last drunk hasn't sufficient force to keep it. In fact, the longer we stay sober, the worse we feel. That sobriety seems to drive me to drink time and time and time again. And I'd come off of these nasty drunks, and it was just a matter of time that the way that I felt was sober felt worse than that nasty drunk did. And the memory of my last drunk doesn't have sufficient force because of the pain that I feel when I'm not drinking. And I would not drink. And I would come to these meetings. And I would see these guys in these meetings saying stuff like, 30 days ago, I was on the streets of Los Angeles. Now I'm the president of the Bank of America. Thank you, you know. And I go, my God, I came in with that guy, you know. But on May 2nd, 1982... I was over at the Beacon Light Mission, and I panhandled some money, and who do I get? I get Don. I says, Don, I'm over here at the mission. I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He said, no. He says, you know where we are. You know what we got. Why don't you get your rusty bird down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. And for the first time in my life, it was up to me to come to you. It was no longer necessary for the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous to be inconvenienced by my nonsense. And I took the longest walk of my life. And at that moment, the moment that he hung up, I was later to find out by meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I had conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And I came to believe in that day. But I didn't come to believe in God, and I didn't come to believe in AA, and I didn't come to believe in my sponsor. But at that moment, I came to believe in what? In the hopelessness and the futility of my life at that moment. That I knew I probably wasn't gonna die. That I'd keep on living that damn alcoholic torture again and again and again. And I realized how powerless I was, that I was like a tail on a kite. It was just a matter of the wind to hit me again, and I'm off and running because I'm powerless not to. And everything in me wanted to stay sober. I didn't want to do it anymore, and I couldn't keep from doing it. And I did what Dr. Bob started talking about, that frightful drinking where year after year you're just there crying, not wanting to drink, and the tears are coming down your face as you're drinking. And you don't know, and you're slamming yourself on the bar or wherever you're at going, I didn't want to do this. What's the use? What's the use anyway? And for alcoholics of our type, what is the use? There's nothing to return to. When you're not drinking, you're miserable and out of your mind. What's the use? If just not drinking is the answer, what's the use? But just not drinking is not the answer. But that's a start. There's so much more here for you. There's so much in store for you here. That it's more than just not drinking. On May 10th of 1935, a stockbroker and a butt doctor got together over there at the Cyberling guest house. And I love Dr. Bob. He was my guy. He still is. And he said, okay, Ann, he says, I'll talk to this guy, but I'm only going to talk to him for 15 minutes. I don't want to hear any more preaching about my drinking. But because he's your friend, I'll talk to the guy. And he started, and they went to the Cyberling guest house. He says, I'll give him 15 minutes. And he came out 4 hours later. And he came out with that beautiful idea. And he says, this guy understands how I feel. This is the first guy that I've talked to who understands how I feel about my drinking. And they had a moment. And they had a moment. And that's why we have home groups. And that's why we have meetings. So we can have a moment. So maybe you and some other guy can have a moment where maybe that guy feels for the first time in my life, God dang it, this guy understands how I feel. And once I believed my sponsor understood I feel, it was okay to trust him with the next indicated action. We had a moment. We had a moment that people like me take for granted, because we got so many meetings now to go to that if we don't like this one, we can go to this one. Back then, they didn't have a choice. They would meet at somebody's house, and there would be eight of them around this little house. And they called it their home group because it was in somebody's houses. And they took care of that thing, and they did chores in that house so that when the newcomer came to that meeting, there was nothing for him to do. And that's why we have commitments in my home group. That's why we have coffee makers and people setting up chairs and literature and greeters. So that when a newcomer comes to that meeting, there's nothing for him to do but sit and listen to the sweet voice of a loving God through the thing called Program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and maybe for the first time in his life, identify with some guy and have a moment. Have a moment of hope. Have a moment in a man who's been scared his entire life, and that the only answer he ever has is always drinking, and that there's nothing in between. And he stays drunk as long as he can, and he stays sober as long as he can, and there you are in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you identify, and you got a little bit of hope. My God, maybe this guy's right. Maybe this guy's got something for me. And I heard that with my sponsor. Can you imagine being with a sponsor? There's nothing to be shocked about here. That's what I love about AA. We've got stuff in our head for so long that when we start talking to people, we think they're going to be shocked. Can you imagine taking a fifth step with your sponsor and you're driving along and he goes, ah, you what? Get the hell out of my car, you know. You shouldn't even have any pets, for God's sake, you know. But I tell you, if it hasn't been done in Alcoholics Anonymous, it hasn't been thought of. Let me tell you, man, you are not going to shock us. Let me believe you, man. I tell you. And on May 2nd, 1982, I took the longest walk of my life. And I asked a man something that I'd never asked a man in AA. I said, "Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor?" And that guy lit up like a chandelier for about 5 seconds, and he lit into me for 20 minutes. And the guy was my sponsor. What a beautiful relationship sponsorship is. What a beautiful thing that is. The most spiritual relationship you will ever have will be you and your sponsor and your sponsee. It's just unbelievable. The first person that I ever trusted, and the hardest question for me to do, ask a man to be my sponsor. And I've learned so much from that. I didn't know what a man was. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I had no idea. I was so busy demanding respect and trying to be something I wasn't. That's why my prayers were always feeling like they were empty prayers. I feel like I'm praying to an empty room. I feel like I'm praying to a pillow. I feel like I'm praying into a hallway because there was nothing in here. And it was because of Alcoholics Anonymous in a home group. I didn't come with a God. I didn't come with nothing but nightmares. I just wanted to sleep through without those crazy nightmares. My poor wife still sees me bellering every now and then. And you guys taught me how to get rid of those nightmares and that fifth step and stuff like that. I had no idea that these actions in Alcoholics Anonymous and taking these steps and making amends, you know, making amends to that little lady, my mom, my poor little mom. I just talked to her today. She's over there in Torrance. She's living in this little room and, you know, 8 floors high, and all the ladies have the same balconies, and, you know, and she's over there with them. And I noticed not too long ago that all the ladies got real flowers on her balconies, you know, and she's got plastic flowers. And I go, "My God, that's your fault, Larry. Why don't you buy her some real flowers?" And I told my mom, I says, "You know what? I'm going to buy you some real flowers. I'm going to put some roses on you." She says, "I don't want them." I says, "No, Mom, you don't have to buy them." I says, "I'm going to buy them, and I'm going to plant them, and we're going to fix your little porch up just like theirs. You'll have real flowers, Mom." "Honey, I don't want them." "No, you don't have to do nothing. I'm going to get..." "Larry," she says, "I don't want any real flowers." She says, "I love to sit here and look at the plastic flowers and watch the hummingbirds suffer." You know what I mean? That lady never wanted me in her life again. She didn't want me. See, I came over there in a drunken stupor and I beat her. I beat her till I got blood out of her nose because I was demanding for a bottle that I knew she had. And I passed out and she had me on her lap and she was rocking. And I woke up because I could feel her tears hitting my cheek. And I remember telling her, "Mom, it ain't that bad. It's not that bad. Everything's going to be all right. I'm going to get it together, Mom. You're not going to have to worry about me no more. This time it's going to be different. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to be something. You won't have to be afraid anymore when you hear the sirens. You won't have to be afraid when you read the papers. Not until I met you. Not until I met you. Not until I found out that it wasn't their fault, that there was nothing to blame, that my alcoholic life was mine to own. My life was my fault. I was a bad son." Putting the word blame out of the picture. You were a bad son. The most powerful powerful column you will ever read will be that fourth column in an inventory. What is your part? And if you don't understand that fourth column, because of that resentment, how did you get even? How did you treat them? I rubbed my folks' nose into my life. I introduced my mom and dad into a level of living they didn't know was out there. And I rubbed their nose in it. My poor father, all he wanted from his son was to go out there and live the good life. I'm 13 years old, and my dad comes marching into my room, and he gives me this 3-page letter of, now that you're a young man, here are some of the responsibilities. And I read this thing on my birthday, and I thought, man, I ain't got a chance. He's talking about, having goals and character and what you should do as a man and respect, and I'm not going to make this. And isn't that amazing? Because of Alcoholics Anonymous and you folks and sponsorship, looking back, that every one of those questions have been answered by you. That all you want for me and my Father wants for me is what my God wants for me, to live the good life and to be useful, to be of service, to be a maximum servant. Dr. Bob says love and service. That's it. That's all. Love and service. I'm so tired of these new folks coming up to me and telling me that AA don't work. AA don't work. Larry, AA don't work. And all I can tell them is this: son, AA don't work for me either. It doesn't work for Michelle. It doesn't work for Ron. It doesn't work for Mike. We work for it. And if you can put your head around that and begin to serve the thing you want so much of it. Isn't it amazing that folks like me who have no idea what a God is? I came here stone resenting God, because what type of God would kill my baby brother? What type of God is that that kills little kids? And I knew I was next. And I didn't want nothing to do with religion or God or anything like that. And isn't it amazing that because of Alcoholics Anonymous and these little things called commitment, isn't it amazing because of Alcoholics Anonymous and these little things called a home group and sponsorship, isn't it amazing that probably the brightest spot in my life was that I found that the more I serve you, the clearer he became. And that the more I serve me, the darker I become. And that if I continue to serve you, he will continue to be in my life. And I'm not looking for anything magnificent. I'm not looking for anything anymore. The most miracle thing in my life as a result of these steps was I found that I had a purpose. And my purpose was to carry this message. My sponsor, Johnny, told me, he says, if I ever had a son, he said, you would be it. And you don't have to love me anymore to make me love you. And you don't have to do anything to make me love you anymore. And there's nothing you can't do to make me love you. All I want you to do, son, is carry this message, Larry. Make sure you tell them what it used to be like and what happened and what you're like today. That's all that we're supposed to do here. That's all I got is my experience, our blessed experience of what happens here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The biggest problem in my life today, Bill Wilson talks about, we will have to survive the certain trials and low spots. And with Alcoholics Anonymous, you will. And if you're not careful, you'll have a problem like mine. The biggest problem that I have is the good life that I live. The biggest problem that I have is the good life I live. Because there's folks like me whose life is so good that they don't believe they need to come back to the place that gave them life. It ain't about getting a good life. It's about remaining useful. Stay useful. Beautiful thing called Alcoholics. I'm making amends to my Father. Became my best friend. And at 5 years sober, having to go through a divorce, and the hardest thing about that divorce was leaving my little girl. I had to leave a little 2-year-old Lauren, and I didn't want to do that. And my wife took off to Phoenix, and I gave her a court order, and she blew it off. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, no matter where that little girl was living, the women said, don't you ever let that little girl wonder where you're at. And women in my home group told me to write that little girl and not to use that yellow legal pad, but to use that Pocahontas paper. And I would write my little baby Lauren all the time. And that if I can fly to Ohio and talk, why can't I drive to Phoenix to see my little girl? And not to ever let her wonder where we're at. And when I would drive to Phoenix, I would take her and have her daughter and daddy dates. And I would take her to those places where she can paint her own coffee cups and ashtrays. And I did that year after year. And every time I would go down the 10 freeway, I would tell myself, you loser dad. You piece of crap. What kind of dad would only see his little girl so many times a year? She needs a decent dad. She needs a better dad. Why don't you just knock it off, man, and let her leave her alone, for God's sakes? And year after year, and every time I would go there, man, I would meet up with her, and it'd be the best weekend of my life. That the most peaceful moments that I had sometimes were when I was writing her that little card or that little letter. And year after year, I would do that. And what happened to me not too long ago is I drove over there, and there's my daughter, and she's 23 years old. We're having a daughter-daddy date, and she's sitting across from me, and she's got her mom's earrings on, and she's got a ball bearing in her forehead, and she's got a ring in her eyebrow, and she's got a ball bearing in her tongue, and a tattoo around her stomach, you know, and she's looking at me, and she says, "What are you looking at?" You know, and I said, "Well, the prettiest little girl I've ever seen." And you folks taught me that, because in meeting after meeting, I'm talking to these guys that I sponsor with their drilled out ears and their tattoos on, and behind every drilled out ear there's an alkie in there, and that's who I talk to. And behind every one of her little piercings there's a little girl in there, and that's who I talk to. She says, "Daddy, I need to talk to you about something." I said, "What is it?" She says, "Well, there's a man in my life." And I said, "Well, that's good." She says, "And I love him a lot, and he means a lot to me." And I says, "Well, that's great, honey." She says, "And he was over at the house last night, and John started crying. He started sobbing, Dad." And I said, "Well, what's wrong, honey?" She says, "Well, here's the glitch, Dad. He's divorced. He's been divorced, and he has a little girl. And that little girl is 7. And he's crying because he's afraid that the little girl is going to forget him because he's not over there all the time." And I said, "Well, what did you tell him?" She said, "Well, it was pretty easy." She says, I told him to write that little girl every couple weeks on Pocahontas paper. She said, "I told him to take that little girl and make ashtrays and paint coffee cups and have daughter and daddy dates." And she says, "John, if you do that, I promise you that little girl will always love you, will always love you." I damn near missed it. I damn near missed it. I damn near talked myself out of that one more time. But you were louder than my head. And I'm so glad, because I met the guy, Johnny, you know, and guy had piercings. He looked like a voodoo doll, you know, and John wants to be a rapper. So I said, "That's great, John." I says, here's one for you. I says, "Put your hand in the air. And put your hand in the air and get your ass out of here and get yourself a real career," is what I told him, you know. But he's a great guy, and she's a great gal. And I tell you, I met the dream. I met my dream here. I met my dream here, what, maybe 17, 18 years ago. I was talking in a meeting in Downey, and I'm sitting there talking, and I lock eyes with a little Nicaraguan lady, and I couldn't keep my eyes off her. I can't keep my eyes off her tonight. And at the end of the meeting, everybody's standing around, and she takes off, and I follow her like a little terrier. And I walk her to her car, and we're talking, and she's trying to get in her car, and I keep talking, and she looked at me, and she says, "Do you like the backpack?" And I says, "I love it." Now, I've never camped a day in my life, you know, but I'm thinking anything to get into the tent, you know. And and I've been calling her every day. And I'm sorry if I don't know how many years we've been married, but I'm thinking 15 or 16 or something like that. But it misses me right now. But the idea is I keep showing up with you, you know. And I love her. And I love being loyal to her. And I love seeing the face and the smiles and knowing that I don't have to hurt her. That I don't have to demand respect. That I can go there and be a good guy. See, she don't need me for anything. She's a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's self-supporting. And she still hangs around me. And it's a privilege to live a life like this. It really is. If you're new, I probably haven't done anything but ramble on, but I need to tell you this. I don't know much about God. I don't know what he looks like, but I can tell you this. On a Friday night in Costa Mesa, I see row after row of people who should be locked up dead or insane. And look at us tonight. We're happy, we're joyous, and we're free. So quit bothering yourself about what he looks like, and let's come back and play in the evidence one more day. Thank you very much.
We hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.